Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 15th, 2016. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Taxman Long.
Taxman, get back just in time on April 15th?
Yeah, just reminding you folks, if you haven't filed yet, better run down to Liberty Tax and get that little guy in the Statue of Liberty outfit to get that off to Uncle Sam for you.
Yeah, because this is it, right? There's no extension to like Monday or anything because it's a Friday.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm always out of the loop on this because I always like to get my taxes filed as soon as I possibly can. I'm the guy like at the mailbox back when we used to have to wait for like W-2s.
Yeah, yeah.
At the mailbox, like, where are they? I want to get this done. You know, because mostly I always overpay and I'm getting a refund. So
yeah.
But I remember back in the old days, back in the newspapering days, right?
Yeah.
Even at the paper before that I met you at, we had a wrong closing hour for a post office. We did like a big tax guy last day, right?
Oh, man, yeah.
And we said a certain post office was going to be open until 8 p.m. or something, and it closed at 6 p.m. or something, right?
Oh, man.
This guy showed up at like 7:30, and his taxes didn't get the right postmark.
Right.
And then he wanted us to pay their the fees or his late charges or whatever. And that's one of those things where you really realize how important your job is as newspapers to get that stuff right.
Because,
yep. You know, as much as you want to tell that guy, hey, dude, you shouldn't have waited the last minute, yeah. You also feel bad that you let the guy down, right?
Yeah, there's a trust there. There's a bond that you make with the newspaper that you know, that's how they get credibility. That's how you trust them.
Exactly. Which is, I'm glad we're out of that now. We don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, no, we just screw everybody now.
We just have to be sure that we don't screw up stuff on the show.
We are the Walter Cronkites of poker castry.
Castry. Well, one thing we did screw up was the Ante Up poker tour up in Mohegan Sun. And so it's nice to be back here in Florida, by the way. I had blast up in Mohegan Sun. Fantastic resort. I mean, I went on and on about it last week, so I'm not going to go on and on about it this week, but really enjoyed it up there. But it was nice to get home after 2 weeks,
yeah. Too,
and sitting in the office here. But the rest of the tournament went very well. I think good reaction from the players, and then couldn't ask for a better story in the main event than what we got this time. Now, you weren't there, but you read the story.
Yes.
So am I overselling it?
No, I don't think so. I think, and it had all the ingredients, you know, of a great story, and then it lived up to it too. So I thought it was really, really exciting, and couldn't have happened to better people. You know, I thought like the way it went, it's pretty cool.
So you know, the funny thing is, when we're sitting there when the final table starts, you know, we get through a lot of emotions or different things, right? One, you're looking around the table and like, all right, who's gonna make the best cover for us?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And not necessarily the prettiest, but just who's gonna be the most interesting person on the cover?
Right.
So without knowing anybody else, that's usually who I end up rooting for. But then you know, you're trying to get a sense of all these people, are learning who these people are, and then. Beyond that, then you realize that you're hunkered down for like 47 hours watching people raise and fold, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, is this really how I got out of newspapers to get into this? But I had fun with this one. This was the first event that I actually live tweeted from. You know, I'm not a big Twitter fan, and we'll talk more about that a little bit later. I did actually live tweet it and had a lot of fun doing it. You know, letting people know. And it was great to hear the players at the break come over and talk to me about it. And then once I got the heads up, there wasn't a lot of excitement there because now we're talking a lot of raise and takes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the one guy was like, hey, my friends were telling me you haven't updated in a while. They want to know what's going on. So that was kind of cool, actually, to get back into, like, the instant news reporting kind of business. So,
right.
So this event, we ended up getting down. There's one guy that just was running over the table, right? And had a lot of the chips in play, and I thought he was just going to... He was probably going to win. He'd have had to put money on it. I would say he'd win. But then all of a sudden, he had two hands in a row against this player that had pocket jacks. And this guy doubled through him on almost two exact hands in a row. It might have been like one hand in between it or something.
Right.
Wild, right? And he doubles through him twice, and now that guy becomes a chip leader, and then the whole dynamic changes. So this is where watching poker is actually exciting, where normally it can be pretty tedious. But to see the dynamic of how things are changing at a table. So then these two players ended up heads up, and they started chatting. They didn't know each other. So it turns out the one guy, obviously I Googled him, and 1.3 million in tournament winnings, which totally confirmed what I thought when I watched him play. Like, this guy is not his first tournament, right?
Yeah.
And then the other guy seemed, he was kind of quiet at the final table for most of the time. He came into the day as the chip leader, but he had lost a lot of chips at some point from day two beginning to the final table. But enough that he was still in it and just being kind of quiet. And then when we got the heads up, I noticed he was real tentative. And I'm like, I don't think this guy has played a lot. So I found out later his biggest tournament buy-in was the satellite that he paid to get into the main event.
Jeez.
So I don't know if that was like $100, $200, something like that. So talk about a heads-up match now, right?
All right.
And, you know, I went totally cliche in the magazine, and you didn't make me change it, but about a David...
I thought about it.
Goliath, right?
Yeah, I thought about it.
What about that lead? You know, I was like, hey, I'm admitting that's a cliche.
I'm admitting I'm being very lazy here,
yes,
but...
Yes, exactly.
You have to see that it's worth being lazy for this cliche.
So they had this heads-up match against the guy that has played for a living for 8 years and knows everything versus a guy who just one day decided to come in and play a satellite, got in. In fact, actually, his wife didn't even know he was in the tournament.
Gee, wow, so, that's
can you imagine that, walking through the door? Hey, honey, I've been playing poker all day. Here's $24,000. But when they realized that they were going to be on the winner was going to be on the cover of the magazine, the guy who's never played a big tournament is like, wow, that's going to be awesome because no one's going to believe that I did this.
Right.
So again, it kind of reminded me of when we all started poker. Why a lot of us get into poker is that anybody could sit at this table and have a good run of cards or a good tournament and do quite well, right?
Yeah, as long as they don't have a handicap system helping them. Sorry. Had to say that. And the Antioch Nation will have to forgive Scott. He apparently is recording from inside a Frito-Lay bag today. I don't know what all that noise is.
Here's what's going on. I was happy that our neighborhood dog is not here today, right?
Uh-huh.
He usually makes an appearance on the show.
Right.
So I got all excited about that, and I forgot that my boy cat has a plastic obsession. He can't lay off plastic, right? So my entire office is a bunch of plastic bags getting ready for next week's Antioch Poker Cruise. And every time he gets into one and I shoo him away, then he gets into the next one. So I finally have scared him away now. So,
well, we are the home of the cat fancier, you know. we don't make sure that our recording areas are pristine and quiet and phones are unplugged. No. We have pets running around, phones on vibrate.
Hey, we're the everyday poker cast.
Yeah. This is why people listen to us, because they want to feel like they're actually there having a conversation with somebody who's not worried about things like phones going off and cats rubbing up against the mic. This is great.
All right, so anyway, back to the poker. So it ended up being a great heads-up match. A couple interesting things about it I'll mention. At one hand, obviously, Brian Altman, who ended up being the champion, the pro, he was, you know, he was aggressive with every pot. There wasn't a pot he was conceding ever, right?
Right.
And so he bluffed on the river. And then Scott, the runner-up, who eventually the runner-up, took a while to think about it, and then made the call, and they turned over their hands, and Brian had 7 high. You know, he was just bluffing at the pot, thought he could take it, right? And then Scott turns over his hand next, and then this mass confusion as everybody's looking at the hands, he had 10 high.
Awesome.
So it made me think, you know, all the way back. Remember that old story about, I think it was Barry Greenstein, right, that made a call with, like, seven high because he figured his opponent was on a straight draw. And if he was on a straight draw, that means he had to have six high.
You're right.
And therefore he knew his seven high was going to be good, which that was just, that's just when I realized that I'm never going to be the kind of poker player that could, because that was just amazing, right?
Yeah.
That's the most amazing poker story I've ever heard. So I don't think that's what happened here. I think probably Scott, unfortunately, probably misread his hand or something, because I don't know how you could ever call a river bet with 10 high in this scenario. But anyhow, he raked in a pot with 10 high. Never done that before.
Nice. Well, I mean, you know, maybe he put him on something like a bluff and thought, you know what, if he's bluffing, he's got nothing, maybe. But yeah, it's kind of hard to not even have a jack in your hand.
Right, the Barry Greenstein formula. Like, all right, I get it. You know, you've determined that he's on the straight draw, so if he's on the straight, he has to have these two cards.
Right.
But here, I don't think that was the case. Maybe it was. But anyhow, it was amazing to watch 10 high and the pot being pushed to him. And this was back before I realized that this was a big deal for him, right?
So, right.
I was thinking for a minute maybe he did have the Barry Greenstein spidey senses then, but maybe he didn't. And then the last funny thing about the main event is, you know, we kind of held the press, as we like to call it, for this issue, right? We wanted to get these results in. So it's finished this Sunday night, and I was going to bang out the story, send it to you, right? So as soon as it's over, I shake Brian the Champion's hand, and I'm like, hey, you know, you're going to get your photo taken, go get your money, because that's the most important thing, right? And then come back and let me, so I can interview for the magazine. He's like, all right, cool. Folks, it's the photo's taken. I'm, you know, writing part of the story I can write without him, right? Then I see him at the window getting paid, and then I'm writing, and I look up, gone. And I'm like, hopefully he went to the restroom or something. Maybe he didn't. So then I'm frantically running around Mohegan Sun, which is a massive casino, right?
Yeah.
Trying to see if I can find him, and I can't. And then through the magic of technology, I was able to get a hold of the tournament director, who happened to get his phone number, called him at the parking garage or something. And I'm like, dude, I need to talk to you for the magazine. Oh, I'm sorry, man. And he came over. Otherwise, it would... this whole podcast and our story would have been much, much more boring.
Well, I mean, it's funny you get caught up in the fact that you just won, that you just took your photo, and, you know, maybe, oh, I forgot the part about coming back to talk to him. So I can understand that.
Oh, absolutely. So. Yep.
But it's glad he was a popular pro that people would have his phone number, you know, to give to you so you could call him.
Well, I don't think he had to do that. I think they just wanted to have his contact in case they needed to get a hold of him for the, you know, because, you know, he won a seat in the, not only on the cover of our magazine this issue, but he won a seat in the NAF World Championship.
Oh, the World Championship, right.
Which, by the way, is going to be fantastic this year. As soon as we get the final details, we'll let everybody know. But I know the preliminary details right now. They're awesome. But anyhow, so they had to send a check out to Thunder Valley for that, so they needed to have all of his information anyhow. So it all worked out, but... But the tournament director had been working, you know, 12 days straight, and as soon as the tournament was over, she was out of there, right?
Right.
Which I don't blame her. So right. I had to find her. I don't know, so it was kind of weird, like bouncing stuff off Soviet satellites and stuff, you know, for this guy to get the story. But overall, we had a fantastic event up there. I really hope they'll have us back. Got to meet some of our Annie Up fans, and unfortunately missed them, too, as well. So I apologize to those who emailed and said they looked for me. I promise you I was there. So you maybe just minute and missed us, but I had a really good conversation with one guy, a longtime listener, who just had a lot of fun. We talked about, you know, Mohegan and Foxwoods and the whole Northeast and everything, and lots of other things. So it was good to get those, and I met Jason from Poker Radius finally, you know, home of our Antioch group discussions. He came out and played an event,
right?
And good to finally put a face to a name there too. So. Had a lot of good fun, and hopefully we'll be, like I said, we'll be back next year, and I'll catch all those of you that showed up and for some reason couldn't find me.
That's cool. You blend right in. That's what it is.
That's it, right? Yeah. And it was funny. Even Jason for the Poker Radius, he was like, I told him, I'm like, hey, I'll be at the Annie Up table in the back, and we have that big huge sign, right?
Right.
So he got in, entered, and then he said, he's like, oh, I couldn't find the Annie Up table either. I guess we're gonna need a bigger sign.
We're gonna need a bigger boat.
But he eventually found us at the break, but interesting. So all right, so I'm gonna close out this and we'll move on to the next thing. A little mini rant here, right?
Okay.
All right, so it was the Saturday morning, I think, right? Yeah, Saturday morning I woke up. I'm always an early riser, right? woke up around 6:30 in the morning and opened my computer to check emails and stuff, and noticed that there was some Twitter activity on our event. Someone apparently during the night had tweeted out that Mohegan Sun and Annie Up refused to honor the guarantee for an event. Now, this is a huge accusation, right?
Right.
And very terrible for NBA's reputation. Unfortunately, it happens in the world. It's never happened for us. I would never dream of us. And again, we're not involved in the guarantees, but obviously by associated by name. So it just it seems so odd to me because it just didn't seem like anything that Mohegan Sun would do. So I kind of let it go, and I figured I would follow up, you know, later in the morning when tournament staff was in to find out why anybody would take this, right? In the meantime, some other guy fired out at least four tweets within 5 minutes of each other between 6:30 and 7:15.
Jeez.
Just trashing us over this. And so I eventually had to send him a message, and I'm like, dude, I don't think this is correct. It might be. Let me find out, and I'll let you know. And if it is correct, then game on. Trash us. But if it's not... you know, you're really harming us. You're giving a bad reputation for us for something we didn't do. So, do you mind just waiting? And he was a little apologetic at that point. And then, of course, you know, once I got a hold of the tournament director, like, literally with 15 minutes from there, he was up early, too, cleared it all up, that it was a big miscommunication, and the guy kind of sheepishly apologized and eventually deleted the tweets. So, but, unfortunately, this all happened at 6:30, 7:30 in the morning, and I don't think anybody was up to see it. But I'm going to ask everybody listening now to just CTF on Twitter, all right? CTFD, I guess, right?
Oh, man.
I don't like Twitter at all. I just don't get it. I don't understand it. It's hard to communicate because you got all this weird shorthand language that everybody's learned. But it's just become such a destructive thing. You know, back in the old days before Twitter, if I had a hair in my soup at the restaurant, right?
Uh-huh.
What would I do? I would ask for the manager to come over. And the manager would come over and I'd be like, hey, dude, there's a hair in my soup. That's not cool. And you know what the manager would do? He'd be like, if he's a good manager, he'd be like, I'm terribly sorry. I'm mortified. That's not should I have happened. Let me get you a new cup of soup. And maybe comp your meal, right?
Right.
And everybody was happy. Nowadays, no one knows how to do that. Now, if any of them are wronged in any way, they immediately are on Twitter saying a company is just terrible and we should boycott them and I hope they rot in hell. I don't understand how we went from that to this. Can you help me understand that?
Oh, I don't know. I think the anonymity of things for a lot of people, I know that this particular person is not anonymous. Everyone knows who he is, and they're following him for a reason. But I think social media in general, yeah, it gives a lot of people the bravery that they wouldn't have, or the chutzpah, or whatever you want to say, whatever word you want to use, balls, that they wouldn't use in real life. And a lot of people love attention. And they want to be the ones to break the story or break the news, or so you're adding all these ingredients and it becomes volatile. Because let's face it, a lot of people are negative anyway.
Right. In general.
Now they have a vehicle of which to, you know, deliver their vitriol. And I really don't know. I know you hate Twitter. I like to see the positive in Twitter. You like to see the negative. And I don't see how this. I know how you sort of couch this by saying, there's this language I don't understand, blah, blah, blah. But a couple of things I want to say about it. One, Twitter is older than our magazine, and it's not new. And it's just now people are thinking it's new, but it's not new. And it's not even, matter of fact, it's starting to fade, and now all these other things are taking over, Snapchat and all this other crap, and they're doing it on there too.
Snapchat would be awesome because that disappears in like 12 seconds.
Yeah. but I see what you're saying, and I understand. But I see that Facebook can be just as damaging, and if anything, they could just make it a much more complete rant. And if somebody has a million followers on Twitter, or if they have a million followers on Facebook, and they do the exact same thing, there's no way to stop either way. And they could do the same things. They can delete them when they want to. But Twitter is this. Yeah, you're right. It's this sort of in the moment. Hey, I'm gonna go to the bathroom. You know, I'm just telling you, I'm doing this from the toilet, and that stuff happens a lot with Twitter. Whereas Facebook, I guess, is more about sharing and more complete thoughts, maybe. But even so, I mean, I could still see this sort of detrimental thing happening to us on Facebook. Somebody going on your Facebook while you're asleep and posting on your page or something saying, hey, you guys suck. You didn't hit the guarantee, which we did, and you know, or whatever. So, but yeah, I think in general, social media, I think, just gives a lot of people, it gives them all a backbone and anonymity most of the time. And it's like, okay, even if, you know, what are the odds that somebody's going to come up against me in Florida when I'm bad-mouthing something in Connecticut or bad-mouthing something in California? We're never going to cross paths unless we just happen to see each other at the World Series, and you probably don't even know what I look like because I'm doing it from a Twitter feed, so I'll be brave. And then even if you do catch me 6 months later, it's going to be like, oh, man, it's just social media, you know? So I think really the anonymity and instant gratification, the world is changing. Cable TV started this. You know, the instant that you want an answer, and then you want to react. You know, originally it was you got your answer instantly. Now you can react instantly. And, you know, people didn't have time. You know, back then, they'd be like, oh, I'm all mad. But then they're like, well, wait a minute. By the time you could actually do something to react to this, it would get back to you that, no, they didn't miss the guarantee. No, they didn't, or they didn't honor the guarantee, whatever. They actually did what they were supposed to do. They were upholding, and you're wrong, and now you didn't embarrass yourself. Now it's like people just react, and I don't know why. I don't know why. I just think that the ingredients of anonymity and social media just are just a bad for something like this. For positive stuff too, it's good. I mean, you know,
oh, absolutely. I understand what you're saying. Twitter. It's not that I don't understand and recognize its positive influences and things, but what makes it a good tool makes it a very terrible tool. So, right. I mean, I don't want to turn this into a Facebook Twitter thing, but I think the difference with Twitter is so much quicker, you know, because there's a lot of everybody retweeting. I mean, no one really reads anything on Facebook, right? You know, you interact with it. But here, this is what happened. You know, some guy tweeted, this guy saw it, and then took with it and retweeted it, and now it's like everywhere, right?
Right.
In a span of like 10 minutes, for no reason, because no one was patient enough to wait until somebody woke up and said, hey, let me get the full story. So anyhow, but I'm not turning this into a Facebook thing. All I'm trying to say to our listeners out there is, from two of us who put everything in our lives on the line to start a business, I just want you all to understand how harmful it is when you send out what you think to be a harmless tweet about bad service or a bad thing or something like this, whether to a company or a person or whatever. You know, I think we need to go back to the days that our mothers raised us to be respectful to folks. So, you know, obviously if you've taken your issue to 27 people at the company and they just refuse to deal with it and are rude about it, by all means. I get it. Now you've exhausted everything. I got to go to Twitter. It's the only way I can get the company to listen to you. But what I'm finding is that's the first place everybody goes now. And I'm asking people not to make that the first place. I'm asking them to take a deep breath, ask people questions, find out the answers, give a company a chance to make something right if they've made it wrong. And then if they don't, then they can go for it. But don't make Twitter the first place you go to complain about this, because I don't really think people understand how damaging that can be. In fact, actually, in this conversation, this guy was like, you know, hey, as poker players, we got to protect ourselves against rooms that don't make guarantees and don't pay them. Absolutely, I totally agree. But that doesn't mean that you can go out there and lie about us not paying a guarantee. Isn't that the exact same thing?
Yeah.
But against us, right?
Right.
So it's interesting the frame of mind that these people have, that it's okay for them to do what they need to do to protect themselves, but they don't really care about the effects of it. So, end of my rant, just asking people, just be nice.
I agree. We should just be nice.
But one last thing I will say about the language, though, because at one point somebody jumped into this conversation and it defended us and kind of criticized this guy for being a little itchy trigger finger, right?
Right.
But he had to use such shorthand that I really honestly couldn't understand it. It is because he had to like tag seven people in it, right?
Yeah.
So I looked at it for like really half an hour because I wanted to find out, is this guy on our team or their team? And I couldn't. And so one of my friends was hanging out with me, and she's a little bit more on Twitter than I am. So I gave it to her. I'm like, tell me what this means. And then she's like, and she explained it to me. I'm like, oh my gosh, I get it. But it was like seven letters, but I had to figure it out. It's like I'm a Nick Cage on National Treasure trying to solve a.
Oh, come on. Couldn't you at least go with, like, the Da Vinci Code rather than that crappy friggin' Nick Cage movie?
Oh, I love Nick Cage. You see, he just got into a fight with Vince Neil, too.
I saw that, yeah.
Not here. Not here.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah, we're halfway done with the show, and we're still on the first item. Thank you very much. Show's going to be 3 hours long.
Oh, man. Very important thing, though. All right, so, you know, we talked about this Global Poker League and the draft, and my big thing, and I think you kind of agree, but it was more my thing, I really don't know what's going on with this. I still don't understand the Global Poker League when they had the draft, right?
Uh-huh.
So we finally have some more details, so I'm not sure how much it helps me, but I'm going to share these details with everyone, and maybe it'll help. So, the first season is going to be 14 regular leagues, plus a five-week summer series. And season one kicked off on April 5th, so they've had their first matches already, and will end November 23rd. The finals will be hosted at Wembley in London. Big place.
That's a huge stadium.
I hope they can fill it with people. Because in the press release, they're talking about all the concerts that have been there, and the UFC, and NBA, and soccer, and stuff. And those places sold it out.
Man. So
I am going to be immensely impressed if there's 100,000 poker fans that are cheering.
That's never going to happen.
So, I don't know. We'll see. They have a playoff system that you're going to announce the details of later. They are producing 400 hours of broadcasting during the regular season, including multilingual commentary during live streams. And I know Alex went on Facebook, or probably on Twitter too, but I'm not on Twitter. Hate it. But on Facebook. And said they had some technical problems early on, but learned from it. So the live streams have started. This is the other thing I think we were kind of talking about. Where are people going to be able to watch this? And it looks like it's all going to be live streaming on, obviously, Twitch, which is the big thing now to be watched. But this new Poker Central Network and other places, and they're going to be adding more places. So there's lots of places you can watch it, but it's going to be online-ish or through your TV through a streaming service of some sort, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then just announced this week that Aaron Paul, the awesome show Breaking Bad, has been added as a wild card member to the Los Angeles Sunset. So I think, I don't know if you're a Breaking Bad fan or Aaron
Paul. I watched it. I binge watched the whole thing in about 2 weeks.
Well, right, because you can't put it down, right?
Yeah, I loved it. It was right? Well, I mean, I think it was two seasons too long, to be honest with you, but it was really good.
So you're probably not watching Better Call Saul now. So.
Well, you know what? I missed the beginning of the first season, and now I can't seem to get the first season anywhere, so I'm going to wait till it's all done, and then I'll just download it and binge the whole thing when it's
binge
over.
The whole thing like you did last time.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of what I think some of us thought you needed to do. I'm sure this was Alex's goal from the beginning, was to cross things over, right? So it's not just poker pros on this. But let's try to get some celebrities mixed in that can play poker and are good at it. And then, you know, obviously by attaching somebody like Aaron Paul, and there's probably other ones that they're working with now, that's going to get some word of mouth and get some people into it that might otherwise not really care about this, right?
The funny thing is that I always tend to relate this stuff to bowling and to see how it works in the bowling, like I did last week with the handicap system thing. They do the same thing in bowling with the tour. They have a league, and then they have this Chris Paul celebrity all-star bowling tournament, and it's really pretty bad. You know, you got these 7-foot basketball players who, you know, have been taught how to throw a hook in the last 20 minutes, and they shoot like a 112, and, you know, it's just terrible bowling. Who wants to watch terrible bowling, you know? So I don't want to watch terrible poker, so I'm hoping these guys really can play and they actually make a difference. And
yeah.
I don't want to just turn on TV and go, oh, look, there's a B-list actor who was on a B-list, you know, cable channel. And, you know, I don't really care about watching him play poker. I want to see quality poker and stars of our game, not stars of another TV show. So,
yeah,
we'll see.
I kind of agree. I think this is probably going to be different than Celebrity Poker Showdown, right?
Yeah.
It was a bunch of idiots playing poker that didn't know anything, and you almost kind of watch it because it's like a train wreck, you know. Right. Dennis Rodman going to call with seven high. and I don't think that would be the case here. Obviously, I mean, there's some higher stakes here than, you know, a made-for-TV show that it was before. So I don't know much about Aaron Paul's poker game, but I'm going to give him a benefit of the doubt that he is better than your average Hollywood celebrity.
Probably. Yeah, yeah. Probably right. Well, we'll see. We'll see how this goes. All right, any updates? Well, we're going to be at sea next week aboard our Antioch Poker Cruise, but don't despair. Don't freak out on Thursday.
You know they will. We told them not to freak out.
We're going
to
record a new show on board like we always do. We'll probably post it Friday. And speaking of the Antioch Poker Cruise, we just added 15 more inside staterooms for our August 26th cruise to Alaska from Seattle. And Royal Caribbean says that's all they can give us because the ship is almost sold out. So if you've been waiting for a last-minute deal to join us, don't. Book now or you'll miss the boat. Remember that for every hour of cash games that you play on board, you get $5 off your next sailing. Get all details at antiupcruises.com.
Aren't you like that? I've just taken the cliche to a new level now.
I don't care.
I'm just out there.
You're just awesome at it.
You'll miss the boat.
You're awesome. Hey, also, Sandia Resort and Casino in Albuquerque, New Mexico will host an Antiup Poker Tour Series this year. The five-event series is unique as it will play out over several weekends. Two-day events are planned July 9th, July 23rd, August 6th, and August 20th, with the three-day main event taking place over Labor Day weekend, where the winner will appear on the cover of the Antiup Magazine. For more details, visit antiupmagazine.com/Sandia, S-A-N-D-I-A. All right, each week we spotlight a listener who calls or emails us, sorry, at a podcast at antiupmagazine.com. Oh, we still got the May 1st, so. And if they haven't won something
karma
from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, we send them something cool. This week's prize is a 30-minute telephone lesson and workbook from Thomas Gallagher Casino Seminars that specializes in poker odds and math at poker911.net. It comes from Dan Black. He says, I wanted to send you an email and let you know how much I enjoy listening to the show. I fell in love with poker during the boom. I'm 23 now, but online poker went away just before I could have really gotten into it. I enjoyed playing home games with my friends, but a $10 buy-in wasn't enough for my friends to be competitive and serious enough. Leading up to my 21st birthday, I think I watched every World Series of Poker main event going back until 2003 and read every book I could get my hands on. My first trip to the casino, I won $180 and I had dreams about playing poker for a living. A few losses brought me back to reality, and since I was in college, I couldn't afford to keep losing $200 here and there. I was very busy and didn't have much time for poker. And then I got injured and had to work full-time and go to school full-time. So poker got put on the back burner. I graduated this past December, and ever since I started my new job in the D.C. area, I've been listening to your podcasts. Listening to all the old shows makes the day go by much faster. I told myself that I would get back into poker and really make an effort to relearn the game that now that I could take the time I used to go to class and study poker. I really wish online poker becomes regulated because I would love to be able to just play a $5 sit-and-go instead of sitting down with $200 at a casino. I'm in the middle of 2011 and listening to the podcast, and your optimism about regulating online poker is depressing now that it's 5 years later and we still don't have it. Once again, I really enjoy listening to your show, and I wanted to reach out and say thanks for helping me get back into poker. You do have young listeners.
Young listeners. Awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. I don't know how we can relate to them, but we're trying. Ranting on Twitter is one thing.
Ranting on Twitter.
That'll do it. That'll draw them in. I know it is kind of depressing when you think about, I mean, it even started way back when we're like, hey, Obama's getting in. He likes to play poker, you know, and it's going to be good for us. And then we poker start kind of come back on its own. They're like, hey, it might happen. And then Black Friday. Oh, now a couple of states have it, but none of them are doing anything really good with it. It really is kind of depressing, but someday it's going to happen.
Actually, kind of funny. My most favorite stories from talking to listeners is when they are in the middle of binging the show, because it's hard. I mean, we do it every week, right? We're focused on it and everything. It's hard to remember back to our frame of minds, you know, 2008, 2010, whenever, you know, and so I would be actually interested to see why we were more optimistic back then than we are now.
Yeah. I remember.
There's probably a reason, but obviously it's a very slow process now.
Yeah, I don't know what it was. I mean, I think it had something to do with the states were going to start doing it individually, and then I think around 2011 or something was when that first started to rise, where states are going to be like, hey, you know what? The Wire Act was the Wire Act. They didn't consider online Wire Act.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, I think it was one of those two things. But yeah, it's just every once in a while something gets dangled in front of us to tease us. And like the California Poker Stars alignment and all that was going. Well, it still hasn't happened. So I don't know. I really thought when Nevada, even though I know there's not a lot of player liquidity there because most of people just go to Vegas and leave, I really thought when Nevada happened, I thought, okay, everyone's gonna be like, look, they're doing it. Atlantic City's doing it. California's gonna do it. I really thought it was gonna happen then, but
yeah.
Yeah. Hey, find yourself in a situation at your favorite poker room or home game and you're not sure what the proper ruling should have been? Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and we'll have Hollywood Casino Toledo Director of Poker, Elliot Schechter, tell you how he would have ruled. This week's prize is an upgraded membership to PokerRadius.com, poker's best social networking site and home of the Antiup Group discussions. Man, we got to start doing the show at night or something. Yeah, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. Morning is not your...
It's not my time of day. You're the early riser, so... it comes from Joel Nemo. He says, we're in a $675 buy-in no-limit hold'em tournament and are three-handed to the flop. The first player to act, sitting in seat one and wearing headphones, threw out a 5,000 chip and verbally announced a raise amount. Next to act, sitting immediately to the bettor's left, asks how much. The dealer states 2,200. He folds and the last to act, sitting across the table in seat seven, asks again, how much is it to call? The dealer repeats, 2,200. Again, nobody at the table disputes this amount. The player says, I call, and puts out 2,200. Now the bettor pulls the headphones off and says, I said 4,200. The floor is called and rules that the last player's 2,200 had to stay, and he could fold, forfeit the 2,200, or call the corrected amount. I later asked the floor how a player could protect himself from another player using that ruling as an opportunity to angle shoot. He told me that I should insist that the player himself be made to restate his bet amount.
Elliot says, wow! This is a very interesting situation. I agree, Elliot.
Yeah.
I disagree with how the floor person ruled here. The dealer is responsible for stating the amount of the bet when requested by the players, and he did this. It can appear to be an angle shot because it was okay to the player in seat one that seat two folded for the supposedly incorrect $2,200 bet. But it was not okay that seat 7 called the same $2,200 bet. In this specific situation, since seat 1 managed to stop the action before significant action had occurred, I'd be inclined to let the $4,200 bet amount stand, but not have the player in seat 7 be forced to leave any chips in the pot if he chose to fold. This is because the player in seat 7 did not have any visual cues to inform him of the bet size. By the way, how loud was it in the area in which the tournament was being held? Was no player able to ever hear anything? If the player in seat 1 had made a bet using an exact change and seat 7 short-called that bet, I would not let seat 7 remove the underbet. Through the oversized chip and multiple times the bet amount was stated, more of the responsibility for the outcome of the situation reverts to the player in seat 1. All too often, it seems as though poker players feel that personal responsibility is really, really great for everyone else except for them. Lastly, the floor person stated that any player not knowing the correct bet amount should have had the betting player restate himself. So they would ultimately become very annoying and turn dealer into pest if this became standard practice every time someone wanted to know the amount of the bet when an oversized chip is placed in the pot. I'm quite certain that we don't need to create more resentment of dealers by players. Poker takes an active and ongoing participation on the part of the players, and that doesn't end after you've placed a chip in the pot or have folded a hand.
This is brutal. I don't see how a floor can look at that player in seat seven and say, you got to keep that money in there.
Yeah.
Twice the dealer was asked and twice the dealer told them 22. If the dealer tells
and
you 22.
The player that made the bet didn't correct it either.
And yeah, so in other words, he's got his headphones on. Another reason why headphones shouldn't be at the table.
Take the stupid headphones off.
But he's got the headphones on, so once he makes his bet, then he blasts the music in it so he can stay, you can't get any tells off me because I can't hear what you're saying, so I can't react to what you're saying. Meanwhile, we're all flummoxed because we don't know what the hell's going on. The dealer said 2,200. You should not be held accountable. After that, the dealer is running this game. Matter of fact, how many times do you say, you know, when you want a chip count or something, you have to ask the dealer, and the dealer has to count it down. But yet, if the dealer told you the wrong amount, and then you called the all-in, he's like, oh, sorry, there's a black chip there for $5,000. Yeah. You were wrong. Now you have to pay all that. No, the dealer made the mistake. So if you're relying on the dealer to run the game, then the dealer said $2,200. You can't make that guy pay more than $2,200. You can't make him sacrifice it either. That's a horrible ruling.
I tend to disagree a little bit here because poker is about your personal responsibility, which obviously Ellie brings up here. And I did have this conversation with one of our listeners of the Mohegan Sun that this does kind of burn my toast a little bit that this is how it's supposed to be run, where the dealers can give you incorrect information and then it's on you to make verify that it's actually correct. I understand why people really hate that, and I'm probably one of the people that hates it too, but that's the rule, so you got to be responsible for the action. Now, in this case, what really made this different for me is that the player in seat one refused to correct the incorrect information, not once, but twice.
Because he didn't hear it.
Right, because he had his headphones on. So if you want to have your headphones on, that's fine, but you have to understand that having headphones on, bad things could happen to you because of that. So if listening to your Motley Crue is more important than getting your bet correct, by all means, have fun. But if you want your bet to be correct, probably going to need to learn to take those headphones off or put the correct change out or something like that. So in this case, it to me, that's the big thing, is that the dealer made the mistake, not once but twice, but seat one, the player, actually had the opportunity to correct them not once but twice and chose not to.
Here's the deal.
So
okay.
At that point, so I mean, what does he say? Well, the guy was saying, "Oh, you should have asked the player." No, I'm never going. I mean, think about that in practice. All right. So, a dealer, if I'm a player and I ask the dealer, "What's the bet?" and he says $2,200, now I'm supposed to say, turn to the player and say, "What's the bet?"
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
People are going to laugh at you, right?
It's ridiculous.
And say, "Dude, she just told you it's $2,200. Why you didn't ask him?" And then you got to give him this whole song and dance. Well, this one time at a casino, the dealer was wrong, and the player didn't correct him, and I was told I had to ask. You know, forget that. No. No. The player was responsible for telling you what correcting the dealer if she was wrong, he was wrong, and didn't do it. So I think what Elliot said is correct. You know, hey, all right, we're going to let this guy have his fantasy 4,200 bet here that no one seems to have ever remembered being made, right? But we're not going to penalize you for it. You take those chips out, you can fold, you can call, you can do whatever you want now that you know the correct bet. But we're not going to make you forfeit $2,200 or 2,200 units because, you know, this ass pickle with his headphones on can't be bothered to correct the dealer.
All I know is that this could have easily been an angle shoot. After the first guy got by and folded for $2,200, now when it gets to the end, he's saying to himself, you know, this guy's going to call, but I was hoping to get a bunch of people to call for that minuscule $2,200.
Right.
Now I don't want to go up against one guy. I wanted pot odds for the suited connectors I have in my hand. Now I'm going to have one guy. Now I'm going to say it's $4,200 to make him fold so I can steal this box. I only have to beat one other player now or him. I mean, it's just not right. Why is the dealer there then?
No, I'm not trying to excuse the dealer here. I'm just saying that it's a different scenario because the player made a bet is as culpable, if not more culpable, than the dealer. There are opportunities where the dealers make mistakes, and it's all on them. This is not one of them.
No, I agree. What I mean, though, is that the dealer said $2,200 twice. You can sure as hell think that that's what you have to bet.
And out of the respect to this dealer here, I'm not convinced that they made a mistake, right?
Right.
There's no proof here that this guy actually made a $4,200
right.
bet, other than him just saying he did.
Yeah, and
that's
not
the other thing, right?
And I'm not saying that dealer made a mistake at all. I'm not blaming the dealer for anything. What I'm blaming is the floor person not honoring what the dealer did, because
right.
That's what we're all taught to do. Ask the dealer for counts. Ask the dealer for bets. Ask the dealer where the action is. The dealer runs the game.
Right.
And the dealer said $2,200. I bet $2,200. Now that it's not $2,200, you're going to make me forfeit that $2,200 or
right.
bet more than I'm comfortable with because the dealer misheard? I mean, that's ridiculous. Imagine if in the game we just ignored the dealer. Imagine if we just ignored the dealer, because that's literally what you're asking me to do now, is to go to the guy in seat one and say, hey, how much did you bet? The dealer says, I already told you $2,200. Huh, screw you. Why am I going to listen to you? Because if you heard it wrong, no, you don't. You listen to the dealer. The
yeah,
dealer is running
Matt
the game.
Movie, and there'd be another disastrous Best Picture nomination.
Yeah. I mean, really, it's ridiculous. I can't imagine a floor making that ruling.
And I'm going to say that when our super fan here, Joel here, went and asked the floor later on for clarification, I'm going to guess that the floor at that point probably realized how bad of a ruling this was and then try to just make up for it, you know, cover stretch by saying, well, okay, that's a good point, but then that's why you need to ask the player. And then, oh, sorry, somebody else needs me over at table 7. Gotta go.
That's the other thing, too, is it's a player. You don't have to answer him. I made my bet. I made my statement. I don't have to say anything now. You know, it's like when they say, well, how much is in your stack? You don't have to say anything. The dealer has to count it down. So why do I have to answer you when you want to know how much I bet? Hey, I did it once. I put it out there. I said it. You didn't hear it. It's too bad. The dealer heard it. Dealer said 2,200. Oh, he was wrong. Too bad. No, not too bad. There's something not right here. You got to take your time with these rulings and really think about it logically. Could this be an angle shoot? Could he have misheard? Did he actually say 2,200 twice? The dealer said 2,200 twice. I can't hold the player accountable anymore. That's just a horrible ruling.
Well, the other thing too is I think this is an opportunity for the floor to let the gentleman know, hey, the headphones are harming your ability to protect your action.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're more than welcome to enjoy your music, but what you let's restate what happened here. You said something. Not a single person at the table claims they heard you, and then twice a different amount was announced and you did not speak up. You need to take responsibility for your bet and take the earbud out when you're in a hand so you can follow that and make sure, you know, unless you're going to put exact change in and everything like that.
Right.
So again, this is what though, I think the very good floors do is not only just come over and make a ruling, but they explain the ruling and then even go to extra lengths to caution people on what they can do to not get in these situations again. I mean, that's I think that's the ultimate goal of any floor is to minimize floor calls in their room.
Mm-hmm.
And you do that by educating your players and giving them helpful tips on what they could do to prevent that. So if someone throws a chip in without saying anything, that's a good opportunity to remind them to verbalize their action, right?
Yeah.
And then if players start learning to do that and doing that, then guess what? There are fewer floor calls.
Of course, he did verbalize his action, and it didn't matter.
Well, yeah, but I know. But in general, what I'm saying is that it's a good opportunity for floor to explain something. And I guess you have to be careful how you do it because some players get all upset if you're like treating them like a 4-year-old. But
yeah,
because they weren't hugged as enough by their mom growing up or whatever. But you have to be respectful about it and just say, hey, just a tip, you couldn't hear the bet being restated twice, so you might want to just pop one butt out when you're in hand, so you be sure you hear the action. Particularly when he was in seat one too, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, how loud was he listening to this music?
The dealer's sitting right next to him.
Right. I mean, he's just like a soft talker dealer and thrash metal. That's the only combination, but I don't think this guy hears, right?
Oh, man.
Well, anyhow.
Well, in happier news, we get to complete O'Malley's move today. Or maybe it's not happier news. Maybe we don't win the pot. Who knows? Here comes part one again.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we're playing at a $2, $5 No Limit Hold'em Casino cash game. This table has a lot of solid players who like to get tricky. We bought in for $500, and after about 2 hours of play, we have pretty much broke even. The blinds post, and we are in the cutoff. The under-the-gun limps. This player is probably the trickiest at the table. He has limped in early position with kings, but has also done a similar move with 9-8 suited, getting in for cheap and busting a set of jacks when he hit his open-ended straight draw on the turn. He also got a $400 high hand bonus when he flopped quad fours. He bought into the game with $300 and currently sits with about $1,500. He is truly a juggernaut. There are two callers to us, and we look down at the ace of clubs, king of clubs. This is going to be a dangerous hand, because it is impossible to get a read on this opponent. With about $20 in the pot already, we account for the limpers and up the 5x table standard raise to 8x, 40 to go. It's folded around to the under the gun, who has the chips ready and snap calls. The other two players fold. there is already about $100 in the pot. When the flop comes down, the king of spades, jack of diamonds, eight of diamonds. This flop is a good one for our hand. We do not have a flush draw, but we have hit top pair, top kicker. We are emboldened with our hand when the under the gun checks. If he once again limped in with some type of suited connectors, diamonds, we want to make him pay. We make a pot-sized bet. Our opponent once again calls, snappily. With 300 in the pot and 140 invested in it, the turn pairs the board with the jack of clubs. Other than king-jack or jack-jack, I'm not sure what type of jack our opponent could be holding. He's tricky, but not dumb enough to play the rookie under the gun at this table. We can eliminate that from his range. Our opponent checks, and maybe this was a mistake, but wanting to keep the pot small, we check behind. The pot is still about 300, and the river is the four of hearts. Our opponent thinks for a short time before shoving. That's right, shoving. He's invested 140 into the pot, and he makes a $1,300 bet. Granted, if we want to see them, we've got to put in our remaining 360. What's the move?
All right, this might be costly for me, but I just don't understand the shove here. It seems like a steal attempt, and I don't really usually associate that kind of move with tricky players. So I gotta admit, I'm a bit confuddled here. But if he had any decent hand, why wouldn't he want a value bet instead of shoving? So I'm going to call here and either win a big pot or get a very expensive lesson in how this player plays.
Yeah, you know, our check, I think, opened the door for this. Whether he has a better hand or not, I think that this type of check really just now is going to put us always in this kind of situations. Since we checked, if he really had a value hand, you know, wouldn't he want to bet a little on or something on the river? So, you know, because we already showed that we are concerned on the turn. Now he's going to want to be afraid. He's going to be afraid to lose some money, some value here by not getting anything from us on the turn. So a shove would really only intimidate us more, which is something someone looking for something wouldn't do. If you need some money or some value out of this, you're not going to want to scare us off. You know what I mean? So, yeah. I think I wrote ARG, are we playing online? Because if we're online, I call, but I know it's a casino game. But, if it was online, I probably call. If it's live, I might fold. So, I really don't know. But I'm just going to say I call because it's live. So, oh no, it's live, right? It's live. Yeah. All right, I don't know. I'll fold. Just because it's live. It's a live hand. If it was online, I'm really struggling with this because it. I don't know. All right. I'm gonna fold because you called, just because of that.
All right. Here we go.
All right. Here we go. Here comes part two.
Hello again. I went out of my mind on this one. He limp called our raise preflop. He check called an overbet on the flop. He checked the turn, and now he's put out a massive overbet of his own on the river. I have no idea where we stand on this one. Could this be a busted flush? He hasn't turned over any bluffs, but he's also won a lot of pots without a showdown. Perhaps he just hasn't been caught yet. What jack is going to shove here? Furthermore, what boat shoves here? Is this your typical overbet to induce a call? I never get around to putting this player on a range because, in my mind, there's simply no range that makes sense. Nothing he has done up to this point has made sense. Perhaps this is a clear fold, but in a moment of weakness, we make the call. Our opponent turns over, ace, ace. We stare at the board and at our opponent's cards, befuddled for what seems like an eternity, before the dealer announces, aces and jacks? We muck and curse ourselves. Perhaps it's time to leave. Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying sometimes some opponents are too tricky to read. In those cases, I recommend just playing the cards. I hope to see you on the felt.
Okay, so I'm going to say it's a very expensive lesson how this player plays. but kudos to him. I don't think this play by this opponent is going to work on me again. So as the great Ray Zielinski would say, savor the flavor. It sure as hell won't happen again.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Tommy Boy.
Oh, jeez. Give me a break.
Oh, my God.
Oh, man. I want to know how many right now.
You got to put the rounders down just one.
I want to know how many people got that reference. How many of our listeners got that reference? Let me know on the show on the Poker Radius.
The imminent classic movie of all time.
Oh, man.
Boy just sold 500,000 brake pads, saved the city, crisis averted.
Oh, man.
Maybe a flavor kid, because it's sure that won't happen.
Please let me know if you understood that reference on PokerRadius.com. I said, ugh, WTF. I guess it really was a tricky player. I think that at the end there, when we're checking, it's like, how do you know we're going to call by shoving at the end? Don't you want to just look, make it like you're stealing? Well, okay, or you got paid off, but still.
We did, right? And I would have called. You look like you were flopping.
Yeah, I would have called. I was just being funny on the show, but I would have called.
So, I give credit to the player for that. But again, that's knowing your opponent, right?
Right.
So there's lots of players out there, I think, when you make that shove there, that they're just going to get out of the way. They're like, I got nothing here, so I got to fold, right? And then you lose value, whether you might get something more out of it. I'm going to guess that this player has calculated that he only needs... It's kind of reverse of limit hold'em, right? He only needs one of us to be confuddled by this and make this call to get as much value out of four people calling a value bet in the same situation, right?
Yeah.
So if we call here and he gets our stack, but then the next three times he does it, everybody folds, he gets no value, he probably still is, in the long run, ahead of the game. Which is actually a very good concept that one of our columnists had in the issue coming out here, right? I forget what show it was. It was Mark Bremmett, I think, probably. We talked about, it's not the value of a play isn't in the what happens in that particular play, but what happens over the course of using that same play.
Right.
And you have to add that up, and then you'll find out that it might actually be positive EV, even though three out of four times it didn't work.
Right. Because you might get three folds and make nothing, and on the fourth one you'll make a ton, and then that makes up for equal, all four times you do the average of it, and it's definitely a winning play. The hard part for me with this hand is the way he played it the whole way through. Not our guy, but the villain. I mean, it was like he had pocket aces, and we just limp, and then we bet, and he just calls, and he checks the turn, and it's like, why did he check the turn? And that, I mean, I guess we could have put him on a jack somehow, but that's a real wet board on the on that flop. And it's so hard to put him on that. Maybe he's afraid of the jack, and at the end, because we checked too, he believed we didn't have the jack. So, but the way he played the aces is just, wow.
Well, I think it's interesting you brought that up, because you go back and look at how the hand played, and there were some danger Will Robinson signs here that pointed to aces. I mean, it's always the under-the-gun limp is always suspicious. It always needs to be suspicious, right? Because who does that? And I would think if you ran a bunch of simulations, you would find out that a high propensity of time it's going to be kings or aces hoping to do the limp re-raise thing, right?
Right.
Sometimes it's going to be, suited connectors or small pocket pairs, people trying to get in cheap and not realizing that it's not profitable to play them out of position like that, but whatever. So I totally glossed all over that. Obviously, I think O'Malley glossed over that as well, too, but you go back and... Which is fun, right? Here, both this and the hind of the week, they actually go back after we know the information and replay the hand, knowing it. And as soon as I went back and read the notes, and I'm like, oh, he limped on it again. All right. Bingo. That should have been absolutely has aces, but it should have been in my thought.
Yeah.
He might actually have his beat here because of that. So.
Yeah.
But
tough. That was tough.
The rest of the hand's kind of weird as well, too, but. He got us a call. So I will say, a long time ago, I was playing down in South Florida on one of my trips, and I had pocket kings, and I made a huge overbet on the river, and got a guy to call, and a player that was there who plays a lot more than I was. He actually came over to me, and he actually remembered it, because like a year later, I was there, and he's like, man, I remember you from last year. You had the kings, and you made that big overbet. I'm like, oh, I guess. And he's like, I used that move from there. That was a great move, and I've been using it now. And I'm like, all right, I didn't really think it was a great move. I just did it. But I get it now. I mean, again, poker's about doing – if you get a smart, logical opponent, they're thinking about the hand in smart, logical ways, right?
Yeah, they're trying to add up a story that makes sense.
Right.
And
so if you do something
the opposite
that's out of that, then that's when you're going to catch them. So all the more reason to kind of – pretend like you're smart and logical at some point, but wild and crazy and idiot at other points, so people have no idea what you're thinking.
Yeah, right? It's a theory of poker.
Yeah. All right, it's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. This comes from Andrew McKenzie. He says it's his second time contacting us, and it's a little situation, it sounds like, but okay. We'll play it out as a Hand of the Week because we never know, right? I was playing a 550 No Limit Hold'em Deep Stack slow tournament online on PokerStars, of course, teasing us. Mm-hmm. 757 entrants, and we were down to the final 26. Blinds are 2,800, 5,600 with a 560 ante. And I'll tell you, this is the one thing I don't miss about online poker.
Yeah.
Are these weird levels.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you can tell it's online by the blind levels.
I mean, it's already hard enough for a mass challenge person like me to figure out, you know, how many big blinds and what my M is. But then you throw in these odd numbers, and I'm like, forget it. I'm done.
Scott's got to make his bet, you know, 55.99 now, you know, instead of the 4.999. It's, you know, makes him mad.
Oh, man. So the average chip stack is approximately 290,000, and we have approximately 137,000. And you can tell that this is only Andrew's second submission because he's using approximately instead of the
squiggly line.
Yeah. So he has 137,000 and is the second lowest stack on the table. He says, I recently moved to this table, and when we went from four tables down to three, so unfortunately I don't have any information on the players. All right, so we're playing blind here.
Okay.
All right, let's see. The other gun player folds. The next player min-raises to 11,200, and it folds to me on the button with king, king.
Well, I mean, you know, we basically raise all the time with king, king, unless we're... I mean, especially we're on the button too. So, I mean, I could see I could find in my vast, you know, playing experience a way to just call here and sort of disguise it. But generally, we want to take control of the hand on the button and raise and get value for this hand. So, I mean,
yeah,
I don't know.
Plus, we're on the button too. Yeah. So we have people have to put us on a wide range there. So I love when people put me on a wide range when I have the upper end of that range.
Yeah. So, I don't know, 34 grand probably I'd make it. Something like that, because why not?
It's actually quite amazing, because he raised to 33,600.
Oh, that's perfectly so three times. Yeah.
400 short of what you did.
Yeah,
you did
that's perfectly 3x.
Folds back to the original raiser, who min raises again to 56,000.
Mm. Well, we know what the third raise means. Kings or aces, since we have kings, I think we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I don't know if queens would do that here. It's possible that somebody with queens who doesn't know, you know, who might be just getting a little frisky, thinks that we were getting frisky, might do that, but or even ace-king. But it feels like a third raise and a min raise twice.
Yeah, double min raise.
Yeah, something's really fishy here. So it feels like aces to me. I don't know if I'd fold, though. That's... I know that.
So this is a good question here, right? So it's both feeling like aces. It's feeling like aces to both of us, right?
Yeah.
But is this a situation where we can pull the trigger on forfeiting that 33,600 we put in with the second best starting hand in poker? Or do we get more involved and find out that we were right and are out of this tournament?
Well, if we fold, we still have 100,000. If we call and then fold on the flop to some massive bet this guy makes, or if we don't hit our king, then, you know, we might, you know, we'd still have 80,000 or so, and the blinds are only 5,600. So, I mean, you still have a ton of play left. So I could see calling here with kings, not re-raising
again.
All right,
so let me ask you about this. So if we call here, and we're already worried about the aces, and we're calling because we're worried about the aces, right?
Yeah, we're thinking about the aces, but we want to see how he plays.
If we weren't worried about the aces, we would re-raise here again, right? Pre-flop?
Right, if we weren't at all worried about aces, yeah, we'd probably re-raise.
So now that we're worried about aces, does it not make our kings look like pocket deuces? And by that, I mean it becomes a set mine. What happens on this board on the flop that makes us feel comfortable about this hand aside from a king or obviously a three-card flush thing that matches one of our kings?
Or Nothing makes us comfortable. I think an ace makes me able to fold a lot easier if the guy
flops. Right, so that's the one thing, right? So if an ace comes, then we could fold with more freedom than we feel like folding that.
Right.
It's the wrong
way.
Less regret. How's that?
Well, the other thing that a call does here, too, is let's say we don't know he has aces. So a call here will now, we're in position, and we'll put the pressure back on him to act first after that flop. And if he acts funny, like if he doesn't bet, like he's scared of what's on the board, or he's scared that we call now and he really didn't have ace, maybe he has ace king or he had queens. I mean, I don't know. I just think that the size of this pot and the amount of that raises probably warrants a call to see how it goes. And we have position on this guy. That's really important.
And it's kind of interesting, actually, that there's a possibility that he could check the flop and give us a shot to catch up. Although, if he has aces, he's probably only checking the flop if an ace comes, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if an ace comes, then we're afraid and don't have to worry about it. So no matter what he puts in after that, we're not going to call it. So I think it warrants a call and then to see how he does. I would not just shove because we have ton of play left if we just call and fold, you know, if we're forced to fold. So I like a call here now,
that's
I guess.
Interesting. I was anti-call on this, but I think you might have come around and got me.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't have my whole tournament life on one hand if I don't have to. I've got so much play left.
No, I don't think. I think at this point I'm predisposed to folding rather than shoving.
Right.
Which is obviously very difficult to do.
With kings.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not that good of a. I mean, sometimes. There have been times where I've done it, but it was just blaring. This is
as I explained to Andy here when in our email back and forth, I mean, that's where you separate the great players from the really great players, right?
Yeah.
The really great players are able to lay down these kings here, where I think mere mortals like us get ourselves in trouble.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've definitely done it before.
It's just in my mind, I'm like, God, I can't fold kings, can I? Really? Yeah.
It has to be really obvious, though. You know, I mean, in this case, I don't know if it's obvious. It's a $5 tournament. You know what I mean? And the guy's making min raises. So, I mean, I don't know if. You know, maybe he doesn't even know how to make a 3x raise. How do I know? I've never played with him before.
Yeah, true.
So, in this case, I'm not folding kings, but I'm not going crazy with him either. So, it's just the internet.
I mean, the other thing, too, is this guy could have something like ace-king, right? So,
right.
But even if an ace comes there, then we're dead, right? So, I really did.
If it comes all unders, we're probably going to get into trouble if he makes a smallish bet, you know. Right. But you never know. The guy might check to you on the flop now. At least give yourself an option. Once you shove all that money in, you have no options except to just hope you have the best hand. Whereas the other way, it's only costing you, you know, another 20 grand or whatever, and now all of a sudden he starts to reveal details about how he plays, about what he has in his hand, and you've gotten that for 20 grand instead of, oh, I'm behind, you know, 7-8-1 or whatever it is, the 7-1 odds that I'm not 8-1, whatever it is, that I'm not going to hit this hand now to beat his aces. So I like the call. Let's just call. Oh, we're not going to see what happens, right? Because you said it's a situation.
Well.
Oh, okay. Let's call.
All right. So you call. All right. Our hero says, here's where I acted too quickly. My gut instinct when he made this raise was that he had ace-ace. But I thought to myself I could do with a double up to get back up to around the average stack. And if the guy has ace-ace, then fair play to him. I probably only thought for around 10-15 seconds before going all in. My opponent quickly calls, shows ace-ace. And I don't get any help on the board, and I'm out in 26th place after around 7 hours of play with $24 return. Sad face. I said, as I said, I'm more annoyed with myself at the speed at which I went all in rather than the decision itself. Thinking back on the hand, I'm not sure if I would have come to a different decision anyway, but perhaps I would have followed my gut instinct that he had aces. However, that might be hindsight making my gut instinct seem stronger than it was. Another thing was that I didn't notice that his initial raise was a min raise at the time, a little lack in concentration, but perhaps noticing the double min raise, I could have folded as it does scream ace-ace. Because anyway, I was just wondering what you guys thought on these questions. Do you think it was obvious my opponent had ace-ace?
The first thing we thought of was that he had it, so maybe it was obvious that way, but we started to talk about it a little more. So I don't think it was completely obvious, but it definitely had to run through your mind.
You probably needed to give it more consideration than he did.
Right, exactly.
Next question, regardless of what he had, was it a bad move to go all in considering the situation in the tournament? And I think this is kind of key here because We're down to 26. We are the second lowest stack at the table, but it's 137,000.
Yeah.
Blinds are 2,800, 5,600. As you said several times during this, there's a lot of play left here.
Yeah.
So the point where he said, I'm going to double up, one, I don't think we were anywhere near desperate enough that we needed to double up. And two, even if we did double up, that would get us to 275-ish.
Right.
And the average stack is 290.
Right.
So that only gets us, we're not even to the average stack if we double up. So do we really want to risk our tournament life just to get to less average. Than average?
Yeah, right.
When we have a lot of chips as the way the tournament's going. So to that answer, I'm going to say yes, it was a very bad move considering the situation in the tournament.
I agree.
Next question, could I min re-raise? I think when he comes back again, he definitely 100% has ace ace.
Well, I would just, why not just call? Let him reveal details of his hand instead of risking more chips.
Well, the other thing, too, is if you do a another min raise there, aren't you now almost pocked him into that point?
Yeah, because it was
therefore, you should probably shove just on the off chance he doesn't have aces, and we might get him to fold.
Because you would
have
made it by 79 or 80,000 at that point, and that's pretty much half of your stack.
Yeah.
So it is half your, more than half your stack. So at that point, yeah. Yeah, so you're just screwed no matter what. I would just call.
He says, is there any argument for just calling and seeing a flop? Obviously, we did discuss that.
Yep.
Finally, any general points on taking time to consider decisions carefully? And I thought this was a good question, too, because it's difficult online, right? Because you only have seconds, literally seconds,
right,
to make these decisions, and even if you have a time bank and that. So you have to be able to make decisions quickly. So I know he said he felt bad that he acted too quickly. Maybe 10, 15 seconds was a little hasty, but I don't know. It's been a long time since I played online. I don't know how much time do you have. 30 seconds? Maybe
a minute? It's like 30 right? seconds, yeah.
So I don't know whether that other 20 seconds was going to help him make a better decision or not. It might have. It might have gotten to the point where you said, hey, I'm just going to call and see what happens. But my advice to him was that when you know you've got to make quick decisions, I think you've got to learn to start thinking about what you're going to do on the next street based on the scenarios that might come up.
Right.
So in other words, you're thinking about, okay, so if he calls here and then the flop comes with this, this is what I'm going to do, and that's what I'm going to do. And start having those thoughts before you get your time. It's on you and you only have 30 seconds. Not easy to do, but that's what makes online a lot harder, I think, than live.
Yeah.
At least in that regard. I mean, live, you could sit there forever.
Well, back-to-back hands, pocket aces screwed us.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, unbelievable. Sorry, Andrew, but hey, you know what? You're on the show. Makes you feel good. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@anteupmagazine.com or call our hotline at 206-338-6344. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@anteupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.